You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hi, everyone. It's been such a pleasure to be here all day listening to such great discussions. And hopefully we have an even better panel lined up for you to round out the end of the day. I have to confess, this is my first time moderating here at Brookings, and I'm not sure if the Brookings folks here knew when they contacted me that they were asking someone with a British accent to moderate a panel on American manufacturing. So soon after the 4th of July as well. But I have been here for over a decade. I'm a dual citizen, and I've been writing about a lot of these topics at National Journal and also for The Atlantic for a few years now. So I do belong on the stage. So this, for our final panel of the day, we're going to focus on workplace education in manufacturing, which is kind of an interesting subset of the bigger discussion we've been having all day about workforce training and how we can make sure that workers have the skills they need to really thrive in the advanced manufacturing economy. So to start out, I'd like to turn directly to my right to Mr. John Hazen-White. He's president of Taco Inc., which makes pumps, valves, and also something else, automation control equipment for HVAC systems, which is, it's a company based in Rhode Island, but they have facilities all across the country. And Taco Inc. has kind of made an interesting move while other manufacturers during the recession really cut back on employee education and training programs. Taco made a big investment in employee training. So, John, could you tell us a little bit more about the Taco Learning Centers and how you, you know, why you decided to make this investment at this time?
Surely. Taco's a family-owned business. It's in its third generation with the fourth present here, actually. And so it's always had a bit of a paternalistic kind of overview, if you will. And so back in the late 80s, we were about a $30 million company that time, and we began to hit some very difficult economic times. The Northeast was in a terrible recession in the late 80s and the early 90s, and Taco actually was teetering on some significant problems. And so at the same time, so we restructured the company, and long story short, part of that was that we had the choice, business did pick up eventually, and we had the choice of retraining or replacing our workforce, because so many companies at that point in time, particularly in Rhode Island, had just gone poof. You know, Brown and Sharp was gone. That was a great manufacturer in this country. Cleveland Twistrill left. Some of these high-tech manufacturing machining companies left or were gone. So we had the option of replacing our workforce or retraining our workforce. And my dad, who was alive and involved in the business at the time, and I had a chat about that, and the decision was to retrain. So we created what went on to become the Taco Learning Center, which at first was just focused on workplace skill-related programs, blueprint reading, gauge reading, quality programs, English as a second language, and has gone on over time to offer something like 150 cataloged courses up through an MBA program and all kinds of things, English classes, literature classes, painting classes, cooking classes, all kinds of wellness and personal improvement things, as well as job-related. But what we've gained from this and what it's all about is the fact that at $30 million in 1991, we had 500 employees. Now we're at about $225 million, and we have 500 employees. So a lot of what we heard this morning is absolutely true. There's been a tremendous move towards productivity and process improvement to allow growth as opposed to adding people. You know, people are a very expensive part of the business, the most expensive. So we have found that training and providing opportunity for people and their families to grow and prosper has allowed us to keep. Oh, and by the way, those 500 people are virtually the same 500 people. Our average tenure is a half a percent, turnover is a half a percent, and our average tenure is 19 years. You know, so that's all from I think providing opportunity for people.
Yeah, it's an interesting program, and one thing that I've been wondering, maybe Congressman, you can help me with this next question. So the fellow sitting in the center of our panel is Congressman David Cicilline. He's a Democrat from Rhode Island, and he's been one of the loudest voices in the House Democratic Caucus for the House Democrats Made It in America agenda. So, I mean, when we're talking about the things that employers can do to really help retrain workers, keep workers, you know, where they need to be more productive, is there anything that the federal government can do to really help employers or incentivize them to make more of these investments? Or is this sort of more of a local issue, a case-by-case
issue? No, there absolutely is a role for the federal government. I want to say it's great to be on this panel with Johnny White.
It is. You know what? Somebody told me I look like an Easter egg.
Who said that?
And your boots match your tie.
Yes, right.
We're actually very good friends for a long time.
But I think the example that Johnny just described of the TACO Learning Centers is really it's very compelling evidence about the importance of investing in the workforce. Mm-hmm. It's hard to separate, you know, the TACO family and the John Hazen White's parents have incredibly, they're icons in Rhode Island, great philanthropists, and were incredibly generous. And so you listen to that story about the TACO Learning Center, you think, well, it's an extension of the incredibly wonderful family, just a nice thing to do. But it's actually a really smart business decision in addition to that. Because what he described is a workforce that is being retrained and provided additional training, that are improving their productivity, that are staying there. I mean, it's a 0.5% turnover. That is almost unheard of. The cost of a turnover in a company is obviously one of the biggest costs as you're retraining. Even those first months of work, you're not getting full capacity because they don't have the skill yet. So this is a really brilliant business model in addition to being an extension of kind of who this family is. And I think the federal government has absolutely an important role in workforce development. First, providing resources. There's been an effort, unfortunately, in the Congress to reduce the role of the federal government in funding of workforce development, which I think is a mistake. There was a proposal made called the Skills Act that would consolidate 35 programs, which sounds like a great idea, but would freeze funding for the next 7 years, which would obviously mean a cut over time. So I think we have to recognize there's a responsibility for the federal government to invest in workforce training. I think we have to be sure that the workforce training programs are effective so that there's real conversations between employers and the programs. What are the skills you actually need for the workforce that you're trying to prepare for, you so that there's a match? You'd be shocked to learn how little conversation happens between the employers and the development of the workforce training programs. And I think the third piece of it is that we have to recognize that, you know, the manufacturing jobs today are not your mother and father's manufacturing jobs. You know, it used to be you could get a high school education, walk down to your local manufacturer, and you could get a good paying job for, you know, above non-manufacturing wages, and you provide for your family. Those, they are much more sophisticated. They almost all require some post-secondary education. And I think the part that we really have to be prepared for, and this is where workforce training can make a real difference, is that the next generation that we're seeing right now of manufacturing jobs really include a big component of art and design. The manufacturing that we're seeing now is really growing out of innovation and design, and when you think about what's happening with 3D printing, this effort of turning STEM into STEAM, to be sure that it is fully infused with art and design, because that's the next generation of workers that we need, not just the kind of technical people have the technical skills, but that have that kind of creative, innovative thinking. And workforce is the place where we can make a difference and sort of position ourselves to lead the world in this way. So I think the federal government has an important role. Now, the advantage is the funding should come from the federal government, but I think all the good proposals look for the development and execution of the plan at the local level. That's the way the workforce model is designed. I think it's the right way. Provide the resources, but let the local governments, local business community, local chambers of commerce help develop those programs so they'll be most effective.
I want to talk a little bit more about changing education needs in a minute, but before we get there, I have a somewhat related question for Elizabeth Jacobs, who is at the end of our panel here. She's a fellow in governance studies here at Brookings, and while she's researched a number of topics, most recently she's been focusing on ways to help American families access economic opportunity. So, Elizabeth, I noticed that you had written quite recently about the problems that young people face in today's labour market. And I wanted to ask a little bit about sort of the issue that young workers face when they're trying to get entry-level jobs in manufacturing. I mean, in this sector, as in a lot of sectors, young people who are fresh out of high school, fresh out of college, are being asked to show work experience. But it's hard to get work experience if you can't get a job in the first place. I mean, do you think that what we really need to see is a bigger focus on apprenticeship programs that are more open to taking on people with less experience? Or, you know, is that sort of model that is very popular in Germany maybe not always the best fit here in the States?
It's a great question. And, I mean, youth unemployment, while we're not quite at Spanish levels or Greek levels, we have a huge youth unemployment problem here in the States with a lot of young people, obviously both college and high school graduates who are trying to make it in the labor market and are finding doors shut in their face for exactly the reasons you talked about. People want work experience in a tight labor market, and if you have a college degree or a high school degree, you probably don't have much work experience, and if you do have work experience, it's likely to be in a relatively low-wage job. So maybe you've worked at McDonald's, maybe you've done some babysitting, but you're not on your way to an upwardly mobile career. And that's why I think programs like apprenticeship programs can be really meaningful, because I mean, they put young people, it takes a specific kind of young person. You have to be willing to sort of have the soft skills, the communication skills to start with, and you need to be willing to work hard, to show up every day, to be part of a very structured program. That's obviously not for everyone, but for a lot of people and many more people than what the current programs are able to serve. I think there's a lot of demand for that kind of thing, and it really could put young people on track to an upwardly mobile career where they have both skills that are specific to a company, but also hopefully more more generally applicable to a broader field, ideally a growing field that's growing in demand. A well-structured program would be one that the local businesses that the congressman was speaking about have really gotten together and figured out, you know, this is the area where we want to be building an apprenticeship program, because we're going to see demand in the future. It's not just going to be a job for tomorrow. It's going to be a job going forward. I would say also that I think this has been going on for a while, but it sort of doesn't seem to quite ever pick up the steam I'd like to see it get, is these career and technical academies. So not just starting after high school is done, not just starting after a student's gotten, you know, maybe a community college degree, but starting before that, whether it's middle school or high school, and really kind of, again, working with the local business community, local community organizations, and figuring out, you know, where are the growth areas in terms of where the economy is going in this region, and then putting together an education system at a local level that kind of connects students to that industry from a much younger age. And so it's not just you graduate from high school knowing algebra, if you're lucky, but you graduate actually, you know, having started building relationships with local businesses, having potentially, you know, interned on a shop floor. You've really started your apprenticeship at age, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, because honestly, I think in Washington sometimes, you know, lots of us have college degrees, we have graduate degrees, we have beyond that. We kind of forget that not everyone in this country is going to go to law school, right? It may seem that way in Washington, but that's not the ultimate path, and I don't think it should be, because we need people who are skilled at making things, at innovating around things like art and design, and are creative in different ways than what you learn in a classroom. So rather than thinking about college for all, I think the administration has kind of started shifting this conversation to a credential of some sort for all, and that conversation can really start much earlier than we often begin it.
Yeah. John, you were nodding a lot there. What are your thoughts on that same topic?
Regarding
helping young people in particular.
We do not have an apprenticeship program per se, because it becomes quite a technical, difficult to manage program. Right. It's a real program. Mm-hmm. We do have internship programs in which we, you know, bring in young folks in the summers or during the year, because there's so much to be gained from youthful thinking and so much to be gained for youth to know that they have capability, you know. But we do not have. I think it's the way the Germans do this is quite interesting. I mean, these kids are in these factories doing maybe nothing to do with what the company does for a long, long time, but learning to work with their hands, to develop some skills. So, yeah, I'll leave it at that, because we're not involved in an apprenticeship program per se.
I think there are some really there's some really good evidence about the value of apprenticeship programs, both in creating the relationships, but also in helping to expose young people to kind of different opportunities and career paths. Mm-hmm. But I think it is also part of a larger problem, that is that, you know, we've got to get away from this notion. I think we've done it as a country for the last decade or more. You know, we sort of disparage manufacturing. We say, you know, manufacturing is dirty and someone else is going to do it and we're going to be a service economy. And if a child came home and said, Mom, Dad, I'm going to be a manufacturer, the parent would recoil and think, what? You know, and we have, that's beginning to change because we have to return to that moment in our country's history, I think, where making things was an honored profession and recognizing that it's a really important part of our rebuilding our national economy and understanding that, particularly with the advent of things like 3D printing, it's really going to change the way we make stuff over the next several decades in this world, not just in our country. And I think, you know, understanding that every single child is not, shouldn't be told, you know, unless you go to college, you're a failure. Like, I used to, when I was married, go to visit schools, and they would ask, in third, fourth grade class, who's going to college? And everyone would raise a hand, the principal would make sure they did. And it was a terrible message. It was suggesting to those kids that unless that were the path they were chosen, somehow they wouldn't have a fulfilling, gratifying, full life. And that's not true. There are lots of wonderful professions, and particularly in manufacturing, where people make a good living, by the way, above non-manufacturing wages generally, and, you know, have great pride in what they're making and producing and selling all over the world. And we need to sort of understand that in the way we design our education system and create career paths, and our career and technical academies have manufacturing tracks so people can learn the skills to become a successful manufacturer and value it the way that it should be valued in our economy.
John, I want to ask a follow-up question about the TACO learning centers and the kind of challenges that you face in your business. I mean, it sounds like a lot of what you've been focusing on is retraining workers. I mean, what exactly does that mean at your company? Does that mean giving people more computer skills? Does it mean paying for them to get an associate's degree in a new field? I mean, what does that mean for you?
Yeah. In the beginning, you know, as I said, it was pretty much of a skill-related kind of a program. So we were just trying to give people basic skills in which they could stay with the company. We began to invest heavily in productivity and automation and process, and we didn't have a workforce that was really equipped for a lot of what we were beginning to do. So the attempt at the time was to give them some basic skills so that they could stay with us. You know, we basically, when we created the Learning Center, we said sort of, here's the deal. We'll provide the facility and the resource for you to learn and grow, but you have to do it. It's up to you. Mm-hmm. And we had like a 98%, you know, enrollment rate immediately, and that's remained consistent. But here's what I learned over time. People are the greatest asset a company like mine has. Not machinery, not equipment, not robotics. It's people. Because when I buy a piece of equipment, no matter how sophisticated, it's obsolete immediately to something better. But there's one asset I have, which is never, ever obsolete, and it's my people. And if we provide them, so at this point in time, the Learning Center is much broader mm-hmm. in scope than job-related programs. It involves summer camps for employees' children. It involves, you know, as I said, wellness programs, gardening, painting, literature, whatever people want. Because not only is it, I think, a social responsibility, but it's a darn good idea to give people the chance to grow and develop.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple.
Yeah.
It's expensive, and that's what scares mm-hmm. people. But boy, the return, and I have never, ever, ever, in the 20 years we've had this program, have allowed a financial justification or analysis to be done on the Learning Center. Because I just always thought, when we do that, we cheapen it somehow.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the return is, but it's pretty darn good.
Yeah. Do you think it's easier for you to make this kind of investment that you're you know, you're not really qualifying in dollars and cents as a family-owned business, as opposed to a big global company that has to every quarter justify what they're doing to shareholders.
I had a debate with a guy once when I was giving a talk at a big convention, and there's 300 or 400 people in this thing, and I was talking about the Learning Center, and this guy in the end said, yeah, he got quite aggressive with me. He was from a public company, and he said, "You can't justify this." Mm-hmm. I said, "I don't have to justify it. It's my company." Anyway, he actually made a point about it, though. I mean, public companies can't really put a definitive return, and they have stockholders that they're accountable mm-hmm. to. I think I would take that bet, even if I was a public company, because it's the right thing to do, and I think you can make a case for that too. But I think it scares a lot of people. I also have seen companies with great programs. Okay. A company right down the street from us was at one time Rhode Island's greatest company, manufacturing company, similar to ours, who was sold. The owner died, the company was sold to a Wall Street group, New York group. And the first thing they did was to close the learning facility. The second thing they did was to close the cafeteria, and the third thing they did was to file for bankruptcy. I mean, I don't know what happened. It was the strangest thing I ever saw. We went this way, they went that way. And they mm-hmm. were a company that we always aspired to be like. It yeah. was a very sad thing.
I mean, it seems like what we're talking about here and what we've really been talking about all day is changing human capital needs and a new level of human capital investment required for the jobs that are still here in the United States, particularly jobs that are well paying. I mean, I want to talk about the employer role here and the sort of workplace role, but it seems like this is a much bigger challenge than one company can take on. I mean, you might be able to train a high school graduate to be a welder in your company, but trying to train them to write complicated software might be a little bit more of a challenge and a bigger investment. I mean, for the whole panel, I mean, do we need to really rethink the way we think about vocational training in the first place? I mean, are we training for vocations that are no longer there?
Well, I think two things. This is going back to something the Congressman was talking about earlier, that the Manufacturing Institute has, I can't remember, I don't know if they have a branding name for it yet, but I've heard Jennifer McNally, who's their president, talk about this rebranding of manufacturing for exactly the reasons we were talking about before, that people think about manufacturing as dirty, they think about it as old, and that's really outdated, that it's actually, manufacturing is, it can be very sexy. I mean, it really is about innovation and design and kind of all of the things that we think about the new economy being is the future of manufacturing, but there's really a disconnect in terms of how the broader public think about it. And so I think that is kind of gets at your question, because I think it is an issue of kind of a culture shift and how do you make that happen. It can't just be, I mean, part of it is one company is at a time, but that's not enough. There needs to kind of be a broader push behind it. And I think one of the challenges to making that happen in the U.S. is that, unlike somewhere like Germany, where you have a really tight relationship between business unions and government that kind of come together and form real intermediaries and can be effective at kind of pushing cultural changes and making policies with broad social impacts happen, even when they might not necessarily benefit every single company or every single stakeholder, they can kind of create this umbrella and build consensus. We don't have that in the same way in the States. The organization of businesses and the way that business operates in the States is very different from the way that some of our global competitors who've done better on this front have operated. And so trying to figure out, I would argue, trying to figure out policies that are kind of moving us in that direction is one way to think about things, as opposed to just, putting funding into sectoral training programs or putting funding into apprenticeships, to always kind of have your eye on this bigger mission of trying to really have the federal government be at the forefront of generating this kind of intermediary role. And I think that can probably sound maybe a little bit like wonky and high level, but I really do think in terms of pushing the conversation forward and moving policy in the direction that I think everyone on this panel would like to see it go, that's a big part of what needs to happen.
And that was, to a point that was made in the earlier panel, that was the sort of force behind the creation of a national manufacturing strategy mm-hmm. to actually serve that convening role to bring in all those stakeholders and actually develop for our country a strategy and then a kind of plan to do it. Because I think you're right, it doesn't exist sort of naturally. And so I think this idea of having a national manufacturing strategy is a really important part of it, which includes, of course, the workforce training component.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another thing that didn't really get discussed too much in earlier panels, though it did come up, that is sort of interesting to me is the interplay of things like immigration reform in these bigger discussions around workforce training. I mean, you mentioned, John, that one of the things you offer is English as a second language, which is probably something that more and more manufacturers are finding, you know, that they need to invest in as the workforce becomes more diverse and demographics change. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, on how, on, you know, if there are new challenges to training and bringing in a more diverse workforce?
Our workforce is in the factory, anyway, is heavily immigrant populated. I would say largely, well, at our employee banquet every year, it's like the United Nations kind of thing. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. But it's heavily Southeast Asian, among others, but we do have a heavy. And so offering, you know, the English as a second language, actually then three or four levels of that, right? It's been important just to be able, going back a long time, to be able to just basic communications, not only skill-related things, but basic policy communications and whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, and I think with immigration reform, it's all the more important.
Do either of you two have any thoughts on that?
I think it's very important. You know, we've heard very loudly from the business community in the immigration debate, which is really important. We heard a great CBO report just a week ago about the impact of immigration reform on our economy, how it will help us reduce the deficit and grow the economy, which I think everyone sort of instinctively knew, but put some numbers to it. But I think, you know, when we look at how do we, what are the kind of national policies that can support manufacturing, we have a, you know, an immigration policy we need to fix. We need to really look in a serious way at K through 12 education. And, you know, we used to lead the world in outcomes in K through 12 education. That's no longer the case. And we, you know, we really sort of workforce training begins in K through 12. And so we have to really understand the urgent challenges there. And I think we also have to be willing to really invest in things like the manufacturing institutes and the Make It in America Manufacturing Act, which is my bill. But, you know, really affirmatively invest in the creation of regional manufacturing strategies and then fund them. You know, we have a culture in Washington right now where people are saying, you know, A, we don't want to spend money, and B, we don't want to spend money sort of picking winners and losers. You hear this argument all the time. Well, the truth is we do that all the time in the tax code. We pick lots of industries that we invest in. And this is a moment, frankly, where we should be really investing in manufacturing. Wages are rising in Asia. Cost of energy is still quite high, so transporting goods is high. There are some things happening that give us a unique moment in the next, you know, decade or so, that if we do the right things, change some policies here in Washington and make some important investments, I think we can really grow advanced manufacturing in particular for our country. And this notion that the government shouldn't be doing that is part of what we're fighting against in Washington, spending money or just playing a role in this area at all. And I think the case is very compelling that it will be an impactful time to do it. But it's been hard to get people to embrace this because of this sort of idea that we're picking winners and losers or we don't have any money to spend on anything, which of course is not true. But
before we go to audience Q&A, I'd like to ask you, and anyone can chime in on this, a question that I always like to ask when I interview, which is there anything that we should have talked about either on this panel or today that has really stuck out to you as a sort of a salient point or maybe something that's a little surprising that doesn't get enough attention? I hope we pretty much covered our bases and we can open it to the audience.
I would say, I mean, I worked on the Hill before I came to Brookings, and I was surprised after, you know, conversation after conversation after conversation focusing on the economic crisis, particularly labor market issues, which was my portfolio, and workforce development didn't come up once, which I came to Brookings was sort of on the top of my list of questions I had, that now that I was kind of back with a research hat on as opposed to doing more specifically policy-oriented work, the question of, you know, why in this time where you'd think that it would be on the table to really be kind of doubling down on workforce development because the economy is slowing down, you have a lot of people who are out of work, workforce development kind of seems like a win-win. You can both keep people busy, keep people engaged with the labor market, potentially give them a little bit of money to keep them afloat, and then when their economy picks up again, have people really raring to go, if not kind of speeding things up, and have the pace pick up even faster than it had been before the slowdown. But it just wasn't on the table, and I don't think I have an answer to that question yet, which is why I still have plenty of work to do. But I think it's worth raising. I mean, the Workforce Investment Act, which is the major federal vehicle for funding workforce development programs at the federal level, hasn't been reauthorized for years. It was, we rejiggered the way we do workforce investment under President Clinton, and then things kind of languished, and arguably there's another sort of round of rejiggering worth doing, but the conversation, for a variety of reasons that I'm sure the gentleman to my left could probably off the record divulge far more on than he'll be willing to divulge from a panel, but I mean, there are reasons for that, but I don't think the reasons are good enough for the conversation to be as stalled as it seems to have been. So I would just kind of flag that instead we've gotten sidetracked by this sort of obsession over the deficit. The likelihood that workforce development programs are going to have any more funding than they have now seems pretty slim when things you would think would really arguably should be going in exactly the opposite direction. Funding is at the lowest level it's been in decades at exactly the time that you'd like to see it bumped up, if not on the rise, given everything that anyone with their head screwed on straight kind of understands about the direction the economy is going. Yeah. Well, so I would sort of put all of those things out there because I think it would be a shame to let this panel go without getting that out on the table.
Yeah. Do you have any
thoughts? No, I think that's exactly right, and I think it's partly fueled by this inability to distinguish spending and investment and sort of this notion that all government spending is exactly the same and all of it is essentially bad. And I think that's part of the challenge. You know, all spending is not the same, and some investments that we make will lead to job generation and the growth of our economy, and some won't. Mm-hmm. And this sort of inability to distinguish one from the other, I think, is one of the great challenges we face in Congress, is there are a cohort of folks who just, you know, look at all government spending and have this unnatural obsession with cutting spending, even at the expense of the growth of our economy or the growth of jobs or helping to, you know, reinvigorate manufacturing, and sort of making the case that, no, actually there are different kinds of spending that will have different impacts, and this is one of those areas where we should be able to reach consensus that this is an investment that will lead to job growth and really is key, I think, to rebuilding our manufacturing economy.
I would add to that, too, that, a very traditional and arguably conservative way to think about the role of government in intervening in economies is thinking about, is there a market failure? And if so, what can the federal government or sort of public spending, whether it's federal or otherwise, do to fix that? And I think the workforce development field is one where it's pretty easy to think about a whole bunch of market failures. You know, not every company recognizes that if they invest in employees, they're going to retain those employees, because the likelihood that you train an employee and then somebody else sees that you've invested all this money in training this employee and they poach that employee and take the person that you just spent all of these company resources on, they're gone. You've arguably wasted that money. It's a kind of a classic market failure where having public spending sort of cut back the cost for a private employer of doing some of that training, because it's a public good what you're doing in training that employee. They become, a public good in the sense that they're good for any company out there that's going to hire them. They're creating value for the economy. And so, I mean, there are a bunch more kind of technical market failures that I could get into, but I think that kind of language in terms of convincing people who aren't, convinced right off the bat of the utility of federal spending and the role for public spending on workforce development, that the market failure frame is one that works pretty well in the space. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the distinction between spending and investment is particularly pertinent when it comes to things like education and human capital, because, you know, if you see your workforce as a cost, it's very easy to, you know, lay someone off and see your costs go down. That's great, we've lowered our costs. But if you're investing in someone, it's kind of hard to quantify how that investment is going to pay off for you. The numbers are particularly fuzzy. It's one of my quests as a reporter to find better numbers on that so I can better understand it myself.
But can I just give you an example of how serious the problem is in Congress? On that example, when we had our orientation for new members of Congress, the last panel was on education. and it was a great panel, and they showed us the final slides where America was in K-12 education, and we led the 30 industrialized countries. Historically, we're always like at the top on, you know, 7 indicators, and now we're near the bottom. And so this slide sort of was, in my mind, a call to action about how we need to invest and reform and do the right things by our system of public education. Well, the first hand went up from one of my colleagues from that famous Tea Party caucus, and he said, can you tell us where in the Constitution the right to the Federal Department of Education to exist is reflected? And so that's the first place they went in the conversation about the urgent critical needs of fixing our education system. And that's what we're up against in large part, is not, you know, just a basic disagreement about what is the role of government. And so it's a, you know, I'm not asking you to feel bad for me, but it's a tough conversation, is my point.
And on that note, I think we're ready to do some audience Q&A. The gentleman in the pink shirt at the back.
Joe Kennedy, I'm an economic and legal consultant, and my impression, in order for something to be an investment, it has to produce a rate of return, not just cost money. And my impression of the literature on worker training is that government programs are not terribly effective, and they haven't been terribly effective for several decades, and I can remember having similar conversations about the need to invest in worker training 20 years ago. And so I'd like to ask the panel, one, do you agree sort of with that assessment of the federal programs, and how can we make them better if we've been trying for the last 2 decades and, you know, haven't really had a lot of success in improving performance? Thank you.
I don't agree with that assessment. I actually have seen many, many examples of people who have participated in good workforce training programs, developed skills, and then been able to either secure or improve their job situation. So I think there are lots and lots of good examples. I think it's a system that would benefit from reform. I think the most important thing is there needs to be a lot better coordination between this, you know, conversations about what employers need and what skills are being developed. And, you know, I think that the most successful programs, there's very close coordination for what the market is demanding, not just in that moment, but for the next 5 and 10 years. And a lot more development and design of the programs by the private sector. And so I think, you know, engaging the private sector in what does the workforce training program look like, who provides it. I mean, I think the least successful programs are often ones that are actually administered by local and state governments, actually run, but instead are administered but run by private industry who actually know the function or know the skill or know the talent. So I think there are really good examples of what works successfully, but I think, you know, our country is filled with people who have gone through job training programs, workforce training programs, have developed a skill and have gotten a job because of it. And I think what you described is sort of the general opposition we get all the time. Oh, workforce training has been a failure. I don't think that's true. I think there's lots of improvement that needs to be made, and there's a lot better coordination. But I think reducing the role of the federal government and providing resources for workforce training is not the answer. I think it's actually we need to be going in the opposite direction. It needs to be really effective, really accountable. But it's, you know, when I talk to employers, one of the things they say is, yeah, I could add positions, but I can't afford the training that's going to go with that new employee. That's an outlay of money I have to write a check for. It's what prevents me. If I could get that training, I'd hire the employer. So I hear that a lot. I think it's real. And I think there's a reason a lot of employers participate in it, because they find the training that's provided to be effective. That's not to say there's not improvement. But I think what you're saying is the argument that is made against or for reducing substantially the federal investment in workforce training, I think that's not an effective strategy.
I would add to that, too, that I think a couple things. First of all, looking at which metrics the evaluations are actually evaluating and if those match with what the program's aims were, I would put that as sort of number one in terms of understanding whether it's an evaluation that sort of makes sense to take at face value as far as deciding whether it should inform policy or not. And number two, I think the timeline that evaluations can operate on versus the timeline that some of these job training programs operate on, particularly good ones, it's often a very short kind of turnaround thing and not looking at somebody's longer-term career trajectory. And so you don't necessarily, and this is a subset of the metric issue, you don't necessarily get, you're not evaluating what the program is for, you're kind of evaluating on a different timeline. And the third thing I'd add that I think, and I may be wrong on this, but I think that the evaluations, the programs that have been most successful are very expensive. And we just don't have that many programs that are funded up to the level to do what the programs need to do to really be good, effective programs. I mean, a good, effective program, particularly for if you're talking about youth labor market entry, a lot of the people who aren't kind of easily transitioning into the labor market have transportation issues, they have housing issues, they have childcare issues. They have a whole life outside of just showing up to figure out how to do the job that might be their job eventually. And they're really, I mean, again, because of this kind of culture of cutting, there aren't that many programs that provide those wraparound services in addition to the intensive job training piece. So whether we're evaluating kind of the kinds of programs that I think anyone who's really pushing reform and job training would like to see, is you're not necessarily comparing apples to apples and looking at the sort of big picture from the literature.
Another question? The lady over there in black. Directly in my line of vision.
Hi, Alicia Saratani with EIR Magazine. I wanted to raise something that I haven't yet heard be part of the discussion, and I might have missed it in the second panel, but I don't think it's a coincidence that the net decline in American manufacturing has happened at the same time you've had a sharp increase in the financial services industry. And if you take the 20th century of America, I think that I would make the case that the two are opposed to one another, that oftentimes the financial services speculative activity happens at the expense of long-term investments. They're really two different kinds of making money. One is real wealth, and one's just money. And right now, we have a lot of money, but we don't have a lot of wealth. And that's why I think that they are diametrically opposed. And everyone knows the story. After the Great Depression, one of the first things that Roosevelt did was he got a Sicilian attorney, Ferdinand Pecora, brought J.P. Morgan to court and basically put on the table all the ties that Wall Street had to Congress and these institutions that Roosevelt was trying to move for a recovery. Then he passed Glass-Steagall, which is a bill in the House. The representative, I think, is a co-sponsor on. There are 70 co-sponsors. There's now a bill in the Senate. My question is, do you really think that we can have a renaissance in manufacturing with all the implications if the federal government does not exert its sovereignty over international finance, bypassing Glass-Steagall and then reprioritizing where billions of dollars of money are going to be spent, i.e. in manufacturing, not in keeping bankrupt banks, to keep it simply, afloat. Do you really think that we can have a manufacturing sector if, and just because Mr. White raised it, I thought that outlook was really important. I think at the end of the day, the American people, regardless of what party you are, don't get a sense that the federal government thinks that the people are the most important resource of the nation, that they still think, oh, we have to deal with Wall Street. They do make money. They tell us if we pass Glass-Steagall, we're going to wreck the whole economy, even though they wreck the whole economy. So at the end of the day, you know, the federal government needs to assert its power, not in a regulatory burdensome way, but a power over supranational finance. That's my question.
I'm not sure how connected the world of manufacturing and the world of financial services are. Maybe our panelists have some more thoughts on that. But I do think that question ties into sort of a bigger picture that is quite important, which is that we're seeing a lot of productivity gains in the economy today going into capital and into the stock market rather than into people and into labor. It's great for GDP. It might not be that great for the average person who is living on an income. Yeah, that's sort of my thought on that question. What do you all think?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think part of the challenge is we should be trying to figure out ways, for example, in our tax code, we reward the gains that are made in the kinds of financial services that you're describing. We treat them more generously in our tax code than someone who grows a manufacturing facility and realizes again. That's an odd notion. I mean, imagine if we flipped it and we actually gave a tax advantage for someone who's building a manufacturing facility and gave a less favorable tax treatment for people who are leveraging, you know, hedge funds. I mean, We do just the opposite. So is it a big surprise that the part of the economy that's growing is the place that, you know, you have the capital markets and the hedge funds, and the part that's shrinking is the... I mean, that's part of the... That's just one example. So I think you're right. We need to be thinking about the way we use public policy to promote the actual activity we want to promote, which is long-term growth of things like manufacturing.
Yes, it's really an interesting point you bring up, the connection between these two things, because from my perspective, and not leaving the government and everything else out of it, just looking back, and this came up a little earlier, in this panel actually, about the need for higher income quickly. Okay, you know, a lot of the move towards the financial services and some of the different businesses other than manufacturing comes from, I think, the fact that going back in history, certainly before my time, a lot of our parents had very difficult lives. You know, they had hard jobs, manual jobs, particularly those coming out of the Depression and whatnot. And so I think there was a long period of time in which everybody's desire was to have their kids do better, right? Therefore, the whole notion of going on to college being an expectation or a real desire on behalf of the parents. Now it's almost an entitlement from the current generations. But therein became a disconnect because there became bills. There became debt, you know, associated with it. So maybe the thought of stepping into a manufacturing job wasn't quick enough pay, or a just return for the time spent being educated, you know. So I think finances have had something to do with pushing people out of manufacturing. Just that's a very sort of ground level approach to that question, but I think it's a really interesting point.
Do you have a thought, Elizabeth?
I would just reiterate a point that Mr. White made earlier about, I mean, the difference between a family-owned company and a multinational corporation. A family-owned company, you know, can base things on the people and what the right thing to do is. And arguably, a multinational corporation should be able to do that, but because they're responsible first to shareholders and because of the way that's evolved in recent times in terms of meeting your responsibility to shareholders means turning over a profit quickly. There's not that much incentive in that structure to really invest in something that reaps long-term returns like training. And so I think, and this is kind of an indirect way of getting at your question, and I'm going to dodge the actual, you know, sovereignty over the banks question, but more broadly, I do think in the same way that we've talked about the need for kind of a cultural shift in the way we think about education and manufacturing and career and technical training, that there's the same need for a shift in terms of corporate responsibility and what it means to do business in the U.S., whether you're a family-owned company or a multinational. I think that we're seeing what happens when multinationals operate and in the way they've operated. It doesn't work forever. Things can kind of fall apart, and you have to figure out where to pick up the pieces and start over. And I'd like to think that maybe there's some space for kind of a shift in the corporate responsibility debate as well.
Yeah. I know. I think that is a shift that is taking place. I mean, the gentleman who up here at the beginning of the day had a lot to say about the importance of training and investing in folks. So that's something to keep in mind as well. The gentleman with the mustache. I know. I can't. I'm trying to get people from all over.
Thank you. I'm Myron Strapp with the National Academies. I wanted to ask what you think should be the government role in stimulating innovation in manufacturing. And have we moved beyond market failures as the rationale or reason for government intervention? And how would you implement that role? How would you make it operational?
We're actually in the House Democratic Caucus. We're working on an innovation agenda right now. But I do think the president has put forth a very interesting proposal in the manufacturing space to create kind of regional organizations to sort of compete for investments to spur innovation in manufacturing. you know, I think there are lots of places the government does it, and I think it's appropriate. It not only has value for manufacturing and growing our economy, it has value for ensuring that we position the United States to be a leader in innovation in the world. And we use our tax code and the adoption of a budget as a set of priorities, a set of important values that we have, a set of important investments we make. And I think anyone who's looked at this thoughtfully recognize that innovation and being sure that we are investing as a nation in innovation and spurring entrepreneurship and innovation is a key part of making sure we remain competitive as a world economy. So I think it's absolutely something we should continue to do, and we should grow our investment in it.
I know this is a place where the immigration debate matters a lot. I mean, it was standalone and has been folded into the conversation, this idea that if you come to the United States from another country and you get a PhD from an American university, we should let you stay. I mean, the number of Silicon Valley innovators who are immigrants is astounding. And so from an innovation perspective, I think that's another piece where the government really, through regulation, can do a lot to do much better than we're doing now, rather than kind of kicking out some of the potential brightest lights for the economy, people who are creating, you know, not only incredible value on a global level, but also creating jobs on a local level. We can keep those people here and let them build what they're going to build in the U.S. as opposed to sending them back.
Can I just add one thing to that? A little off, maybe not right down to your point, but I still believe, firmly believe, that America is the greatest innovative society in the world. And I say that not necessarily from a factual data standpoint. I say that as a very proud American. And I think what our government was intended for was to help support this country. And so I think their support in the area of innovation, because innovation is expensive and it's difficult. I mean, those guys this morning, my gosh, what he was talking about, you missed that, but I mean, the billions that they drop on failures in the drug businesses, the legitimate drug business, is incredible. And so I think that the not everybody can do that. And so I think that the support that our government can give to innovation and technology and development and to market activities is really important somehow. But it has to be monitored and not scandalized, you know. I can remember, and I'm sorry, I'm way off track now, but it's my show, right? No, I'm kidding. That was a very arrogant comment.
John is a trustee here.
Sorry. Sorry about that, Daryl. He's responsible for me. But I remember my first job when I got out of college was in the Bay Area in California. I lived in the East Bay. And those were the boom times of solar, you know. And we're in the pump business, so we were selling pumps and controls and things to the solar business. Well, there was huge tax credit benefits to putting in solar. So people were getting a solar system for $16,000. It was really worth about $3,000, and they got a pool with it, or they got a satellite TV or something. You know, there was every scam in the book was run on that, and Reagan squished that when he came into office, which was the right thing to do. But so you have to control these things,
that's right.
You know. But I think it's a really there's some benefit to be had.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh no, go for it. I think we have time for one or two more questions. The gentleman in the black jacket.
Yeah, Pat Malloy. I was formerly a general counsel of the Senate Banking Committee, so I think you're on to something very important when you're talking about the broader corporate governance issue. I was, you know, 30 years ago, we had the stakeholder theory of capitalism, mm-hmm. that the corporation was responsible for its employees, its community, its shareholders, and others. And then we morphed into this shareholder value only theory of corporate governance. And then other countries could incentivize through underpriced currency subsidies for the outsourcing of American production. and the increase in the trade deficit. It's all related. So I was struck by Mr. White talking between his private company employing people and investing in them and the public company closing up shop and firing people. So I think, and Ms. Jacobs has talked about this as a broader issue, and the congressman has talked about a national manufacturing strategy. You can't deal with your trade deficit without dealing with this broader issue. So I think this panel has been terrific in putting those points together.
Great. Well, thank you for a statement. That's great because it gives us time for more questions. The gentleman in the blue shirt in the back.
Hi, I'm Ben Robinson. I'm an intern at the Metropolitan Policy Program here at Brookings, and we've been doing some work on advanced manufacturing as well. And something that we've been seeing on the ground in places that we've been talking with employers, and this has been a hallmark of the economic recovery in general, which is a bit sad, is the growth in temporary work. We've been seeing a lot of temporary growth in temporary work, even in manufacturing. So I kind of want to see what your thoughts are on that. It's kind of goes against the grain of workforce investment. Mm-hmm. While that is happening, there still are some really great examples of companies like yours that invest in their workers, and there's a great Hitachi Foundation case studies of really great examples of companies that invest in their workforce. So if you're interested in looking for that, I found that really helpful. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of want to know what your thoughts are on the growth in temporary work and what it means for manufacturing and the workforce investment in manufacturing.
That's a great point.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's going to increase. Mm-hmm. By the way, there are certain real advantages to temporary employees in the case of seasonal businesses and whatnot. I can see, but we've tried to steer clear of it because you don't really have the full attention of the person if they're a temporary employee. But I think in response to the health care program, and the costs that may inflict, which I don't think are known yet. We've tried to analyze that as well as we can. You know, it's sustainable for us. But this is a way for people to get around that a little bit. And I think we're going to see more temporary employment. Mm-hmm.
And this is particularly a problem sort of at the low wage end of the income scale. You know, people who aren't making a lot of money to start with and now, having a less attractive set of jobs, even in manufacturing, which historically has been a sector that people think of as a place where folks can come in at a low level and, you know, move up and make a decent wage. Does anyone have any more thoughts on that?
I wonder whether, and this is just speculation, but I wonder whether temporary work isn't all that different from the increase in the use of part-time work that we've seen over time. Because, I mean, part-time work avoids a lot of the same expenses of having a full-time worker. You don't have to provide benefits
sure.
the same way, even if
yeah.
you're a company that actually does provide good benefits and a good wage to workers, which many companies don't, even for their full-time workers. But if you are using part-time workers, lets you get around that. So I wonder, I mean, shifting to a temporary model versus part-time mm-hmm. is kind of adding insult to injury, I guess, because you're not even there permanently part-time. But I think this strategy of companies saving money on labor costs by kind of recategorizing workers is an old one, and I wonder whether if temporary work is kind of a new level of bad or whether it's just kind of a new strategy to do the same kind of thing that we've been seeing for a while, which is not at all to make an excuse for it. It's part of a broader problem that's very definitely not good for workers and arguably not good for the economy as a whole. But whether it's a new problem or whether it's a new name for something that we've been trying to figure out how to deal with for quite some time is not totally clear to me.
I think we have time for one more question. A gentleman in the front row.
Thank you. Bob Mann with TACO. I have a question about manufacturing and national security. Does the government have a policy? You talked about a national manufacturing strategy, and if we had one, is there a concern on the government's part and a responsibility that we retain strategic industries for national security purposes? And if so, are we acting on that?
I mean, I think there is no question that we have a responsibility to do that. We do it in the way the government contracts in certain industries. but I think people have not given enough thought to the long-term consequences of not protecting and strengthening the manufacturing sector in our economy, that, you know, what you're talking about are what will be the implications for national security over time. And I think it is just one more reason that we should make manufacturing a national priority, and that we should have a set of policies, both tax policies, workforce policies, education policies, that really support the growth and strengthening of manufacturing because of those implications.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I think we are out of time. Thank you all so much for joining us today.